Hello and welcome to QSO. It's all about ham radio. And this week's show, we're talking to K1RV, Pi, and he's talking about the Museum Ships Weekend. And you'll want to stay tuned to this and find out about 78 museum ships across the country on the air on amateur radio this weekend coming up. It's all coming up right here on QSO. How many of you would like to operate 80 meters, but you can't because of antenna restrictions? Well, that's over. You can operate 80 meters right now. You can operate from your home, your apartment. You can take it on the road with you. It's the brand new Transworld Antennas 8080. Go to their website and check it out, transworldantennas.com. This is a portable antenna, but it can be a permanent antenna. It's stealth. It's not a low-profile antenna. This thing is a performance-driven piece of engineering. You need to see it. It will be at Dayton, and you need to hear one of these on the air. If you want to operate 80 meters and you can't, I love the 80-meter band. I can't imagine not being able to operate on 80. But nonetheless, if you're in that position, don't stay in that position. Go to the website and check it out, transworldantennas.com. Go up there and take a look at their brand new 8080 and look for it at Dayton. Our guest today is Pi. His call sign is K1RV. And, well, you know, this fella is into a multiplicity of things in terms of amateur radio. First, Ham Test Online. If you've seen the banner ads or you've talked to someone that's used Ham Test Online to get their amateur license, well, this is the man behind the scenes. He's the fellow that has Ham Test Online. Also, we've got something very special coming up this weekend, and this is the main thing right now that we're going to be talking about, and that is the Museum Ships special event. Pi, just tell us about this. This is an exciting thing. I've talked to a number of people that get all excited when they work these ships.
Yeah, it's a fun event. This is International Museum Ships Weekend 2009, and this event began as just kind of a couple of us here in the Boston area just thought it would be a fun thing to do, to see if we could do a special event on board a Navy ship, a museum ship. And we got permission to get on board the USS Salem, which is located in Quincy, Massachusetts, and played around a little bit. I was able to get a vanity call sign for the club. We decided we were going to have a club, and we got K1USN, K1 United States Navy. And between the time that we started talking about doing it and that first July in 1997 and the time that it actually took place, we already had close to 8 ships lined up. And it has taken on a life of its own since that time. And now there, I just checked again today, it is 78 ships that are going to be participating this year.
78 ships.
78, yes. And
there's going to be
there's
going to be an amateur station on each one of those 78 ships on the air communicating.
That's correct. When I started to say there have actually been some other ships that have I'll say come and gone. Some of these ships are no longer are in existence. We could talk a little bit about that later on, but other ones that were able to maybe get on for one time or another, but this year, just looking at the list, there are actually, I'm looking here now, there's probably at least 10 that have never been activated before. So it's a lot of fun. It's a great time.
Well, give us the name of some of these ships.
Well, I mean, we have the 3 aircraft carriers. I mean, people always, you know, you think of large vessels. They don't get much bigger than that. We have the USS Hornet, the Midway, the Lexington, and the Yorktown. Those are 4 carriers. Then there's at least 7 battleships, and I don't see the battleship Massachusetts on there. And I was told they're going to be on the list, so that might make it 79. A bunch of Coast Guard cutters, several cruisers. There's one over, and if you were to go to the website, you could really get a good look at the list of all of the ships that are going to participate, and that's Very simple. It's sponsored by the Battleship New Jersey, and their call sign is NJ2BB. So the website is just simply NJ2BB.org, and you'll see the list. And as I said, as of today, there's 79 participants.
I guess maybe what you could do as well is to talk about the location of these ships, where they're going to be located at. And I don't know if you have that in front of you. You may not. It may be too many locations to account for. But maybe some of the key locations that you know where they're going to be located at.
Well, as I look down the list, and I do have the list right here in front of me, as I'm scanning down the list, if you go to the website where they list each one of the vessels, you can, and they also have the call signs listed, there's in 90% of the cases, there's a clickable link that people could go to and click on this and see immediately a lot more information about each one of these operations on the ships. But there are many here in the United States. Just looking at some of the other countries, Great Britain, Germany, Austria, France, several in Australia. Spain, Sweden, Belgium, and Denmark. And some of these are light ships. There are several light ships. There are a number of submarines. Now, the submarines that's a very active group of people that have helped put ham radio on some of these museum submarines. And so there's a large number of submarines that are going to be part of this.
So submarines. See, when you said museum ships, you know, I was thinking, I'm thinking ships. You folks have actually got submarines that are participating.
You look at the list and you say, well, there are a number of destroyers, an icebreaker, a couple of LSTs, several light ships, minesweepers, some passenger ships, cargo ships, one of the victory ships, the SS Red Oak Victory out in California, and again, many submarines.
Okay, now let's say folks want to participate in this. They've never done this before, or maybe they've listened to it a little bit. See, I had heard about it, but I always miss it. In other words, it's always over with, and someone says, "Oh, by the way, did you hear all the ships on the radio?" And I was like, "No, I've missed it again." You know? But for those folks who would want to participate in it, Is there any specific frequencies that they operate on and times and that sort of thing where folks can find them, or are they just up and down the bands?
Well, let me give you the time frame on this. It's a 48-hour event, so it begins at 0:00. We always go by universal coordinated time, so it's 0:00 on, which would begin Friday evening locally here in the United States, or 0:00 Greenwich Mean Time. And then it runs for 48 hours continuously. So depending on the location of each one of these ships and depending on the number of people that are involved in getting it on the air, you would find during that 48-hour period, you're going to see there will be some operation from each one of those ships. Now, so it's this weekend coming up. If you're listening here right now to this live this week, the event begins. It's June 6th and 7th, but actually it's going to begin Friday evening here on the East Coast. It'll be 8 o'clock on the East Coast. We'll begin operation at K1USN. We'll start operating for several hours Friday evening and then be back at it for the next couple of days.
Now, what frequencies will you guys start on?
Yeah, we have on that webpage, there's a number of the suggested operating frequencies, and they're in the... for the most part, they're all in the general class portion of the DHF ham bands, so that someone, if they have a general class or above license, they would be able to find the operation of these ships. The easiest way for me to say is that the frequencies end in 60. We tried to do that on purpose to just give it a little bit of a sequencing, but all of these single sideband frequencies would be something like 3860, 7260, 14260, 21360, et cetera. and all of the frequencies on CW end in the number 39. And you go, well, what the heck does that have to do with it? Well, we began this on board the USS Salem, and the hull number on the USS Salem was 139. So we just decided to put the 39 there as a, so it's like 3539 and 7039 and 14039. Those are the CW frequencies.
Well, very, very cool. Yeah, so at 8 o'clock Eastern Time on Friday is when this is going to roll out.
And it's just going to keep on rolling for 48 hours.
So then, of course, during the day, you've got all these different frequencies. Now, they're listed on the website, and folks, what we're going to do is we're going to give you the website again. We'll give out the URL several times, and if you don't have pencil and paper handy right now, you'll have time to go get pencil and paper or pen and paper and write it down. It also, this broadcast is always, and I always forget that we're up in the podcast mode, so folks have a chance to download the thing. So you may be catching this a little bit after the fact. It would be nice if we could catch some of the audio off of this at some point in time. And Pi, I don't know if you have the ability or you have some friends that could record parts of it, but I think that would be a real interesting thing to air a little bit of.
That's interesting. We may be doing some recording, some video recording, of our operation at K1USN. So we certainly could we'd get some audio from that would be available.
Yeah, that would be cool. I want to start doing more of that here on this radio show because folks are busy. I mean, I don't know what it is. It seems like I don't know if it's just I'm getting old or what it is, but it just doesn't seem like we have time anymore to do things we did when we were younger. And even for the younger folks that are listening, I know your schedules are as hectic as all of ours, so we miss out on a lot of things. It would be nice to capture some of the audio from all the different events and things that take place and have it on QSO so that when a person downloads a podcast, they can hear a little bit of this.
There was a little mini adventure that we did several years ago on board I'd say the mother of all museum ships. We got an invite, and it was pretty short notice, but we got an invite to go on board Old Ironsides, the USS Constitution, which is the oldest commissioned ship in the U.S. Navy, and stationed here at the Charlestown Navy Yard just next to Boston. They invited us to come out for one of the turnaround cruises, and they said, if you guys would like to get on the air, we'll make it happen. So I think we had about 2 weeks of time to scramble and get everything all together, and we went out. It was the time when a new destroyer was being commissioned up in Bath, Maine, and they came down and they had the USS Constitution go out to meet that ship as it came into Boston Harbor, and we also had one of the other museum ships that's at the Charlestown Navy Yard, the USS Cass and Young, which is a World War II destroyer, was also towed out along with the Constitution, and we went out and met the other ship, and then we all circled around Boston Harbor and came in. So for about 4 hours, several of us, we were on the air from Old Ironsides, and I tell you, it was one of the premier moments of my ham career was to be able to be part of that and just have this massive wall-to-wall pileup, and the band conditions were fantastic, and we had a dipole that was up on one of the masts of Old Ironsides, and an ICOM 706, and I was we just had a roaring pileup. Well, one of the people in our group that wasn't able to directly participate, he was at home, and he recorded a lot of the audio, and so, when the dust settled out from the whole event, we got tons of QSL cards that came in and everything else, and we were able to actually. I'll send you a copy of this because you might get a kick out of it. But we had a little DVD, and what we did was we superimposed the QSL cards from the stations that had worked us that I was working while we were on the air with the actual audio from the which he had given he had recorded during the event. So it was really kind of it's just exactly what you're saying there to actually be able to relive some of that.
That's, that to me is really fascinating. We got to take a break. We'll be right back with K1RV, Pi from Ham Test Online, and the Museum Ships Weekend.
If you like to travel, if you're a camper, if you'd like to take your ham radio hobby with you when you go, you need the Trans World Antennas TW2010L Backpacker Antenna. It's the same exact antenna as the TW2010 Adventurer, with the exception it's been streamlined for the person who likes to camp and travel light. It's the same rugged antenna structure as the TW2010, with the black powder coating and stealth design. We all know the TW2010 is a great permanent or portable antenna, but the TW2010L Backpacker takes portable and emergency operation to an entirely new level. It's especially suited for the amateur operator who loves backpacking, cycling, camping. It makes easy access and quick setup possible for the most extenuating emergencies. TW2010L Backpacker Antenna is available now for a limited time for only $399.95. That's right, $399.95. Pricing includes backpacker, quadra stand, carrying bag, and free shipping in the continental United States through FedEx Ground. That's transworldantennas.com. And now for a limited time, only $399.95. That's transworldantennas.com.
Have you been looking for a place to put a website? Have you thought about putting your own website up, or possibly you've got your own right now and you're not real happy? The name to think about and remember is tux-support.com. Tux like Tuxedo, the little penguin, the mascot for Linux, the Linux operating system. Tux-support.com. Just remember that name. If you're looking for a website for your amateur radio club, your church, your organization, your business, or even a personal site, you need a place to put that site, and you want a simple way to put it together and maintain it. One word or one company to remember, that's tux-support.com. Tux-support.com. That's T-U-X-S-U-P-P-O-R-T. Tux-support.com, the only name you need to know when it comes to your website. As you're listening to QSO, keep in mind, we would really like to hear from you. We'd like to know where you're listening at. We'd like to know, what are you listening on? How's the signal coming in? Are you listening by means of podcast? Are you downloading from iTunes? What kind of station do you have? How many family members do you have? What do you do for a living? We want to know. We want to know all about who you are. And please write us. Now, what you can do is just go to the website, tedrandall.com. That's TEDRANDALL.com. And there's a tab that says Contact Ted. Jump in there and send us an email and say hello. Plus, it's really important that we hear from you, because it's something that we can show our sponsors. We want to keep QSO on the air. So be sure and write us. Jump on that website, tedrandall.com, and go to Contact Ted and shoot us an email. We'd love to hear from you. We're back, and our guest is K1RV. Everybody calls him Pi. And I asked him why that was, and he started to explain it, but it was pretty complex.
And irrational. I mean, Pi is an irrational number, and I've been accused of being that way myself.
Anyhow, you've been called Pi for how long now?
Since I was about 14 years old, right around the time I got my ham license.
Okay, so then you really don't need to explain it then. See? It's just
right.
An established fact. Okay. Well, you know,
some things just are.
You know, one of the things that I found really interesting here, and that is, I was looking at the website, and there's mention of if you work 15 of the ships, you get a certificate. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yes, and that's because of the large number of ships now. It's been made, you know, much more of a challenge. I think originally we probably had, I think in the earlier days, we had fewer ships involved, and we probably required maybe 6 or 8 contacts with the various ships. But now, with 78 ships participating, it's really not a difficult thing to work 15. It's, you know, you have to work at it, but nowadays I'd say many people will get on the air and set their goal at, all right, this weekend I'm going to try to work 15 or see how many ships I can work. You can watch the packet cluster. I know you've probably had discussions before on the show here about the packet cluster, but That's something where you can you just watch on the packet cluster, and you'll see all of the ship activity this weekend. All the call signs will be spotted up there, and people will tell you what frequency they're on.
Now, let's slow down just for a minute, though, for the folks that don't know what the packet cluster is, or they don't know what you're even talking about. Take us to the base level here and explain exactly what it is you're referring to, so that they understand.
All right, I'm trying to. I want to say the best. If I could spell it correctly here, I wanted to go to the DX Summit website, if I could, which pretty much explains it. What I'm going to talk about here, but there's a website and it's called DX Summit. It's in Finland, so it's www.dxsummit.fi for Finland. And you go to that website, and it will explain an awful lot about just what does take place with a packet cluster system. And packet cluster is something that nowadays many people use the internet for what used to take place over the radio, as far as these spotting of stations. And if I could just say, let's say you have 10 people that are around the United States, and they all have radios, and they're all listening on the 20-meter ham band, and I hear a station in Florida that's on 14.323 or something like that, and what I would do is I'd say, oh, that's kind of an interesting station, and I could put his call sign. I just type his call sign in, and the frequency. Sometimes some of the radios and computer programs now automatically read the frequency from the radio, and as part of the program, we'll just automatically put that up. So now I've gone on this website, and I've said that such and such a station is on 14.31213 or whatever the frequency was. And now anyone else that's connected to this network at that time would see this. Well, if the other 8 or 9 stations that are on at the same time here heard other stations, or they had a little bit more information about that particular one, it's like an online chat room, if you will, where people are telling you what they're hearing on any given time, on any given frequency. So it's like instead of you having one set of ears to listen to things, you have many, many sets of ears. So when an event like this takes place with the museum ships, you would just get onto this network and you would see all the spots on there, and people will sometimes have additional information. They might tell you who the operator's name is on that station, or what their QSL information is, how to get a card from them, or things like that.
So that would allow folks, I guess I want to say, to locate the ships quickly. And I would think that would make it almost effortless to work 15.
Well, that's part of it. I mean, that's going to tell you where they are. Well, if you have, if you have a modest station, and this is what we like to do, is we like to say that this is open to anyone using any kind of equipment. And if you have a modest station, it should not be a difficult thing. This will make it easier for you to find out where the stations are, and where you might, when you might be able to hear them from your location. It doesn't make it effortless, though, because if you get in there and you're one of 100 people that are trying to call at any one time, well, you may have a 1 in 100 chance of getting through at that particular moment. I mean, being on the other end of things, on the receiving end, as I have from it, it's a lot of fun. It's a real adrenaline rush and everything else for us as we're operating, because we want to try to have as many contacts as we possibly can. We also like to tell the people a little bit about the ships that we're involved with, and a little bit of the history, and try to balance that out. But when you have 40 or 50 people calling you at one time, it really can become quite chaotic.
Well, yeah, but I guess I was thinking it would make it easy to locate them on the dial, not necessarily easy to work them.
Oh,
you know?
Yes, right.
You know, a pile up is a pile up, you know. But, you know, that's another thing, too, with contesting. Sometimes I wonder a little bit, like, for example, with this particular weekend, the museum ships thing, I'm thinking that sometimes I wonder if we don't get just too caught up in exchanging 599, whatever, and moving along the road, we work as many stations as we can, but kind of miss the point of the fact that each one of these ships has a unique story behind it.
Well, that's where the fact that that we, and it's true, in order to maximize during a 48-hour period, as I said, you try to balance things. If you're on the end of the pileup, where you're trying to work as many people as you can to give them the contact, you still want to be able to impart the message that you're trying to give. Well, if people go to the website of the museum ship's website, from there is usually a clickable link to each one of the websites of the individual ships. Now, from that, there may be a fair amount of information about that particular vessel, but there would also be the information about where to send for a QSL card. Now, most of these QSL cards are very collectible because they more often than not have a picture of the ship on one side and then the contact information on the other, but a lot of times a lot of history about the ship too. I have a friend of mine I was talking with him out in Dayton at the Hamvention, and he's one of the people every year that tries to see just how many it's a competitive thing, of course, and he's, I think each year he's had he would maybe contact 30 to 35 of the ships, which is quite a task out of say 75 or something like that, to get almost half of them, and he's been pretty good at it. But he says he has QSL cards from over 60 of the ships now.
Well, you know, I guess too, it's no different working a ship than it is working another country. In most cases, we work countries that we don't know anything about. You know, the names come across, but we don't have any idea, you know, about what the country looks like, what the topography is there, what the people are like, what their customs are like. And so many times I go back to the gentleman that first ever showed me amateur radio in action, and that's a fellow by the name of Nelson Cosby up in Detroit. He told me, actually Dearborn, Michigan, he says, I always ask what their occupation is. And that stuck with me.
That's a great conversation starter.
Because, you know, it's amazing when you'll talk to some guy, you know, and in some remote land, and you'll think, you know, I bet this guy works out in the banana plantation, you know, and you come to find out he's an attorney, you know.
So, right.
But it's so fascinating. My goodness, there's so many different things that people do. And as you get into foreign countries, of course, it's even more fascinating because there's professions you run into that we don't have here on our soil. And the museum ships, I that's what I'm saying. I'm drawing a parallel. You know, as we work these things, as folks have a chance to work a ship, I would think the contact would be far more rewarding, you know, if after the contact was over with, they were able to, you know, reflect back and read through some of these things to find out just exactly what was the story behind that ship. I worked that ship, you know.
Right. Well, you know, as I said, a lot of times we try to work a number of stations, and then maybe sometimes if things time permits, we'll give a little bit more information about the individual vessels. We find that oftentimes people will be sitting on the frequency for a while listening to the conversation. So, you know, you wouldn't have to give that information out during every single contact, but, you know, every five or 10 minutes or so, you give a little bit more information. And so the people do have a tendency to learn a bit more. It's not just like if you were in a contest and you're just trying to work as many countries as you can during the course of a weekend or something like that. That's a little different. But, you know, we have a lot of return. I mean, we keep all of our logs in computer, you know, it's computer logging. So we see a lot of people that we work from one year to the next, and you have a lot of people that are longtime friends over the period of time.
Well, I know I've had several friends of mine in ham radio that will tell me, they'll say, wow, I worked all those ships, you know, this weekend. And I'll think, well, I missed out on that one again, you know. And they're all excited. It's like, oh, man, you wouldn't believe. And they start telling you the whole thing, you know. And so when you told me about the event coming up, I thought, well, we've got to get this on the air before the weekend. We have to do this. Because
that's great timing.
I hate folks missing out on something like this, because this is really an unusual, special event that takes that, that's taking place on ham radio. And in addition to that, this is a lot of fun for shortwave listeners. Even if you're not working the ships, being able to tune in and hear all these hams work a ship, talk to them, and from all the different locations on the planet, that all the different people calling and making conversation, to me would have to be one of the most fascinating listens, you know, to...
I'm pretty sure now. Although, as I said, the group from the battleship New Jersey, they're handling all of the certificate arrangements nowadays. I'm pretty sure that they have the same standard that we had when we were handling this, when the K1USN group was, that they also issue certificates to shortwave listeners who keep track of the of conversations between, say, 15 different contacts, 15 different ships. So. I'm sure they could just send an email off of the website there to find out for sure, but I'm pretty sure that they also issue certificates to shortwave listeners for doing the same thing, getting the confirmations.
Well, that in itself would be very, very cool. It's time for a break. We'll be back. Our guest is K1RV Pi, and we'll be back right after this. Week after week, you hear us talk about Transworld antennas, and you hear us talk about the TW2010, the 4040, the Backpacker, and all these different antennas. Of course, the TW2010 Adventurer came first. Folks were amazed at its performance. Then they introduced the Backpacker, and now the 4040. Go to EHAM and read the reviews on the TW2010. Just go to EHAM and read those reviews. Now, you can do that by going to transworldantennas.com. Just go to transworldantennas.com. Transworld Antennas, one word. Go to transworldantennas.com. There's a link on that page that'll take you right straight to the EHAM reviews, or you can just go to EHAM yourself. And if you're a ham, you know how to get to EHAM on the internet. Just Google it, you'll get there. And read the reviews. See what other amateur radio operators are saying about this antenna. Thank you.
Since the beginning of time and across the history of radio broadcasting, there's only one radio station that has ever earned a full-length documentary dedicated totally and completely to its rise to a pinnacle never before achieved by any radio station and its fall. This is a story of what happened when the most legendary programming genius of all time takes the reins of an obscure Canadian radio station in the small city of Windsor, Canada, and creates a radio legend that rocked the Motor City, the USA, and half a continent.
That does it for Big Tom Rivers, 1971, and Hank O'Neill starts a brand new year next at CKLW. For the last time this year, I will say to you, rock on, mother!
Ladies and gentlemen, the beat goes on.
CKLW.
2020 news guys, they were disc jockeys without music. Bum, bum, bum. And everybody knew that something was going to happen. You knew something was going to happen.
Motor City Mayor Roman Gribbs has a mad on for an unidentified rapist, a butcher knife-wielding pervert cornered a secretary in the elevator at Detroit City County Building and rode her to the vacant seventh floor and proceeded to sexually assault her. Guards are now being considered for future surveillance of the crime-stained seventh floor. Lee Marshall, 2020 News.
Now, Markham Street Productions takes you there as you relive the rise and fall of
the Big HCKLW, the Motor City.
You can now own your own copy of this new DVD documentary, Radio Revolution, the Rise and Fall of the Big 8 from Markham Street Productions. The special edition DVD of this award-winning feature-length documentary includes extra scenes, outtakes, photos, and special features. Radio Revolution, the Rise and Fall of the Big 8 is now available for only $29.95 plus shipping. Go to RadioRevolutionDVD.com. That's RadioRevolutionDVD.com. Order now while supply lasts. RadioRevolutionDVD.com. That's RadioRevolutionDVD.com.
And the hits just keep on coming.
CKLW. the Motor City.
As you're listening to QSO, keep in mind, we would really like to hear from you. We'd like to know where you're listening at. We'd like to know, what are you listening on? How's the signal coming in? Are you listening by means of podcast? Are you downloading from iTunes? What kind of station do you have? How many family members do you have? What do you do for a living? We want to know. We want to know all about who you are. And please write us. Now, what you can do is just go to the website, tedrandall.com. That's TEDRANDALL.com. And there's a tab that says Contact Ted. Jump in there and send us an email and say hello. Plus, it's really important that we hear from you because it's something that we can show our sponsors. We want to keep QSO on the air, so be sure and write us. Jump on that website, tedrandall.com, and go to Contact Ted and shoot us an email. We'd love to hear from you.
We are back, and our guest is K1RV. Pi, he's with the Museum Ships Weekend special event this weekend, along with Ham Test Online. And while we were at our break, you were telling me that you were up on a webpage right now, and I missed part of that. Why don't you tell me a little bit about what you were talking about?
Oh, well, I mentioned earlier that if people would like to see where some of the ships are operating this weekend, find, you know, get a little jump start on things as far as the frequencies, they can look on the, I mentioned the packet cluster, and of course I get onto one of the local packet clusters here, but a very good website that's international. It's called the DX Summit, and that's all one word, DX Summit. .fi would be, that's S-U-M-M-I-T, dxsummit.fi, and you go to that website and just click on the thing that says DX Spots, and you just watch. It's just continually updating, and, you know, it's telling me what's going on, who's hearing who on what frequency right now, and, you know, there's a station in Puerto Rico that just said that he just heard someone in the Balearic Islands on 6 meters. So that's pretty good. You know, in other words, here's a chance. We're saying that 6 meters is open. Well, we're kind of hoping that during the Museum Ships weekend, we'll have some good propagation. And this is a great way to find out what the propagation is on any band.
Well, you just mentioned you had seen a Boy Scout station on some frequency.
Yeah, no, that just kind of scrolled off the bottom of the screen. But while we were talking, and I don't know how to quite do a save back on this particular website here, but, you know, it's telling you, it said it was some kind of a Boy Scout club station that was operating on a frequency on 20 meters at that particular time.
Now, let me ask you this question. Do you folks, while you're doing the Museum Ships thing, do you work any Echolink or IRLP at all through this?
We certainly have in the past, and I don't know how much they concentrate on that now, but I'm pretty sure that they do that. We're at K1USN. We'll be on node number 4320 is the local node that we will be monitoring from K1USN. And that's a good question to ask. I'll send a note down to the people at the Battleship New Jersey tonight, and maybe they can put something up on the webpage if it's not already there. I may not have seen it, but regarding perhaps there'll be a reflector on at least on IRLP.
That would be a cool thing, you know. And I hear this all the time. I hear people say, you know, well, I don't want a computer in my shack, you know, and this Echolink is just not ham radio, you know. And I just disagree. I mean, I'm sorry.
I love it. You know? I love it. You know, I got sold on IRLP, you know, it's like early on. I was out visiting my parents in San Diego, and I had a walkie-talkie with me. And the guys back here in the Boston area were in the midst of building up an IRLP board for the local repeater. And you know, I sent some emails back and forth to them that particular weekend while I was in San Diego, and they said, okay, get on such and such a repeater in San Diego, and they gave me the frequency and tones and everything. And, you know, within a very short time, all of a sudden, I'm sitting in my parents' backyard with my little Yaesu walkie talking with all the gang back here in the East Coast. And it was just like, I mean, that's all I have to do. This is great. It was a lot of fun. So since that time, I've been totally sold on it. And we did a lot of demonstrations. When we were doing a lot of our activity on board the USS Salem here, we had a lot of scout groups came through. And we had things set up so that I could crossband, and I could be standing out on the deck of the ship talking with a scout group. We'd crossband through the radio that was in one of our radio rooms into the IRLP link several towns away, and have the kids talk with someone down in Antarctica. I mean, that it's pretty, you know, I as a ham am impressed with that, and certainly people like scouts and the leaders, they were pretty impressed with it too, with a walkie-talkie. You could talk with Antarctica.
Well, you know, I guess I get a little bit discouraged with 2 meters. Something happened here the other day that was just amazing. So, and someone really ought to just shoot me, okay? I was looking for the local repeater, and I happened on another repeater here in town that I've known about for a long time, and I knew it was an IRLP repeater. Matter of fact, it's a very good friend of mine that runs the repeater. And I got on this thing by accident, and I just parked the radio there. We have a standing joke. I went to a ham fest and bought a 2 meter rig for $5. Okay, now of course I've got a ham shack full of stuff, but you know this was my $5 radio, and I brought it home and tinkered with it and got it working. It sits on the bench, half disassembled, and I'm actually talking on this thing from day to day, and my two sons think it's the funniest thing. They make fun of me, and Holly makes fun of me. But anyways, the way the whole thing worked out, I had it on and I was listening, and I didn't realize the machine I was on. All of a sudden, there comes a burst through, and the snowed fires up. And there's this young kid out in Denver working some sort of a kids contest. And I jotted his call sign down because I did plan on calling him and seeing if I couldn't get him to come on the air. But anyways, I listened to that for a few minutes, and there was a guy came back to him almost all but immediately. And they made the contact and whatnot, and then he signed off and went on. Well, a little while later, there was this very strange sound I heard, and it was almost like a sound effect is what it was. And it was some remote location on the planet. I don't know what it was, but you know, they were playing seagulls or ducks or something, you know, that was indicative of that part of the world. And this person came on and signed their call sign and called CQ. And somebody local once again came back to them and worked them and all that kind of stuff. And I listened. I guess I had that thing on. I've had it on that repeater ever since. And I guess, you know, there I am. I'm totally ignoring the magic of this IRLP repeater. And right now I'd have to vote at number one in the Nashville area. I mean, as far as being of amateur radio entertainment value, that thing is priceless. You know, you hear these people checking in from just all over the world, and they're.
Did you listen in Dayton? Did you listen to any of the IRLP repeaters there?
No, I had no no 2 meter rig on.
Okay, because that's really what IRLP should be. It was constant, one contact right after another. It's great. You'd hear somebody checking in with his, you know, some friends back down in Key West, and then someone else would come on and check into. Say hello to his friends back in Germany, and or somebody that couldn't make it to the from San Francisco that couldn't make it there was calling his buddy who was out on the flea market. It was great, and it's not the same as some of the other stuff. I mean, I'm a dyed-in-the-wool CW guy and everything else, but I love all aspects of amateur radio, and I think it's a great tool.
Oh, it was just very, very fascinating, and you know. One thing that what was the little gal's name we interviewed there at
Emily
at Dayton,
yep.
You know, and she said, she hit the nail on the head. She says, I find 2 meters boring.
I know it.
And she says, there's nobody on talking. Well, you know what? In a lot of cases, you get on a repeater and the local folks, they get upset. It's like, you know, what are you doing talking on the radio? You know, it's like. Well, isn't that what we're here? Oh, well, now, you know, this is for emergencies only. And, you know, oh, man, I've heard it all, you know. And so listening to this IRLP machine, which in Nashville it's the 147015, and the call sign is AF4TZ. I found it fascinating. I found it, you know, I'm working a lot and I'm doing a lot of stuff in regards to the radio show and audio editing and things. So I like to have something on in the background. And I found that just completely, totally entertaining. It really was. It was just a pleasant experience, and it left me in a far better mood. You know,
do you happen to know what the node number is on that?
No, I certainly don't.
Oh, okay. No, because what I was going to say is, if somebody wanted a chance to actually talk with you on the air on 2 meters, maybe they could connect to that node, and if you were listening, they'd have a chance to speak with you.
And that's the case, because I do at this point. I've got it on my $5 radio, listening all the time, because I can't really shut it off. I mean, it's like,
oh really, that, you know, kind of radio,
you know, it's like an old woman in her soap opera, man. I mean, I've got to have this thing on and listen to it, you know. And that's another thing too, and that is activities like Museum Ships Weekend give the radio listener something really, really cool to listen to, something that's not, it's educational, it's entertaining, it's challenging. And it isn't, you know, it isn't just the same old stuff that a lot of folks just get bored with. So I think that's such a needed thing right now in this hobby. And especially if we want all of our shortwave brothers to come on board, and sisters, I should say, to come on board and get their ham licenses and get on the air. And we'll talk about that in just a minute. We'll take a break. And we'll come back and we'll talk about a little bit as to, if you're a shortwave listener, how it is that you can get on the air. And K1RV can tell you how it's done. And we'll be right back.
It's
right
the 4040.
This.
It's a new 40-meter monoband antenna. It looks just like the Adventurer or the TW2010. It's the perfect antenna for high-performance DX communications in a portable package. This antenna system is ideal for camping, emergencies, or permanent installation where you gotta go stealth. 7.0 to 7.3 megahertz without the necessity of either manual band changing or the need for a controller. Just attach the feed line and you're ready to talk. That's the Trans World Adventurer 4040. Go to their website. Take a look. Transworldantennas.com. That's transworldantennas.com.
As you're listening to QSO, keep in mind, we would really like to hear from you. We'd like to know where you're listening at. We'd like to know, what are you listening on? How's the signal coming in? Are you listening by means of podcast? Are you downloading from iTunes? What kind of station do you have? How many family members do you have? What do you do for a living? We want to know. We want to know all about who you are. And please write us. Now, what you can do is just go to the website, tedrandall.com. That's TEDRANDALL.com. And there's a tab that says Contact Ted. Jump in there and send us an email and say hello. Plus, it's really important that we hear from you, because it's something that we can show our sponsors. We want to keep QSO on the air. So be sure and write us. Jump on that website, tedrandall.com, and go to Contact Ted and shoot us an email. We'd love to hear from you.
Our guest is Pi. The call sign is
K1RV. And this gentleman is involved with the Museum Ships Weekend event that's coming up this weekend, incidentally. And if you're listening by means of podcast, it's probably already over with, you know. But you can mark it on the calendar for next year, because this event just keeps getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And I said that we were going to talk a little bit, even to the shortwave listeners, as to how you can get your ham license. But before we do that, Pi, you've got some things you were wanting to talk about.
Yeah. Well, I just wanted to mention one last thing here. Anyway, as far as the Museum Ships event, this is the granddaddy event that takes place each year. But that just, you know, draws everyone together for this one particular operating event. But many of these museum ships, there is an operation taking place at other times, and what they want to do is they would like to have visitors come to visit their ships and learn a little bit more about the history. So oftentimes you will find operations taking place from each one of these locations. Now, in our case, with K1USN, and that's the station that I'm trustee for, the K1USN Radio Club, and we're a historic Naval Radio Association, and we are located now at the Thomas A. Watson Library. Now, you go, well, what the heck does that have to do with museum ships? Well, Thomas Watson was the person that was on the other end of the telephone call that Alexander Graham Bell made, and he took some of the money after when Bell invented the telephone and used some of that in the local economy in the Boston area and decided to build an engine company, which quickly turned into a shipbuilding company, and he built several destroyers and lightship. The work just got so big with the Navy contracts, he moved the operation about 2 miles further down the river to deeper water and larger quarters. But we're located, the library, the Thomas Watson Library, is located right on the original ways, if you will, of the original shipyard. And from the shipyard, what became the Four River Shipyard, there were well over 1,000 vessels, naval vessels and commercial vessels, built in the lifetime of the shipyard. So it's a pretty historic place, and Thomas Watson certainly played a big part in the local and in the Boston area as far as the shipbuilding industry is concerned. And that's where we'll be operating. We have a nice club station there. We'll have three HF stations and a VHF station, and we've now got a beam up and everything else. So hopefully people will be able to hear us, and we'd love to work as many stations as possible, and we'll have a nice special commemorative QSL card that we'll be issuing too.
Tell me a little bit, before we jump track here, tell me a little bit about how you first got involved with the museum ships project.
Well, the other fellow in the area here, who he and I used to get together on the local 2-meter repeater, which is our local IRLP repeater, node number 4320. His call is W1QWT, Quebec Whiskey Tango. And Bob Callahan, he was a radio operator in the Navy. And, you know, we talked about different things. And one time he said, you know, we've got the ship over here in Quincy, the USS Salem. I wonder if we could possibly get on board and operate sometime. And I think I started to lead into this earlier, that ended up turning into a club on board the ship, and we operated for a number of years on there, and then that just became something that was no longer going to be manageable on board the ship with some changes of administration and things like that. So we were very fortunate to have the local military archivist, Jim Fahey, who was instrumental in getting us into the Thomas Watson Library, which is just up the river from the shipyard. So it worked out great. But that was 1997 when we did the first one, and then here it is 2009, and this is just, it's taken on a life of its own, and we're just glad to still be part of it.
Now, you're going to be from the library, but now are they also going to be operating from the ship as well?
Not from the Salem. There's no longer any operation on board there. That's why we wanted to at least be able to continue with K1USN, and so we've been here now at the library for several years.
But now, let me ask this question. This may be a dumb question. Why did you folks have to cease operation from that ship?
Well, as I said, it was some sort of, it was an administration change on board the ship. Each museum ship, I think if I were talking to some of the people that are from different groups that I've dealt with here in the over the last, since we began this, these sort of things happen. Local museums, sometimes things just no longer become workable. And I know of several other ships that had been on the air in the past and are no longer, which is kind of a sad thing.
Well, I would imagine that the person in charge of the museum ship or the local organization, you know, that operates as curators or whatever, you know. They would have to have some knowledge and some background and appreciation of amateur radio to probably be able to even relate to it, if that makes any sense at all.
Yeah, well, that's true. Now, there's another little interesting side note with the USS Salem. Part of that project where that ship is located, there was a German two-man submarine called the Seehund. And when I say a two-man submarine, this thing is only about 30 feet long, and it had a crew of two. And there were only a couple of them that survived World War II. And one of them is located right next to the USS Salem. And there will actually be an operation taking place from the parking lot this weekend right nearby the Seehund. And they have a special call sign. That's WW2MAN. And if you could get the gist of what that would be, I mean, it's a World War II submarine. And so, so it's WW2MAN. And that will be activated this weekend.
Oh, very cool. Yeah, and that's another thing, too, that we lose sight of. And that is, you know, our hobby has moved away from the general public to some degree. And there are not massive amounts of people. Matter of fact, I would say the majority of people have no idea what amateur radio is. You know, a good example is my son Matt drives down the road with his large Tar Heel on the back of his Volvo. And people invariably, you know, will pull over or roll the window down and point at this thing. And some of their expressions on their faces, it almost looks like they saw a monster. You know, it's like, what is that? You know, what is that thing? You know, and you cannot in just a matter of, I guess I want to say, 10 words or less, tell them what this hobby is. They haven't got a clue. And it seems to me like we're getting further down that road, and we really ought not to be. In other words, it ought to be if someone says amateur radio or ham radio, oh, you're one of those guys. I mean, it really ought to be that way, but it's not. And so when you find a situation like what you're talking about, it's totally understandable in my way of thinking in that we're foreign to a lot of folks, and I think we have to keep that top of mind, and we constantly have to be in the position of spokesman, in the position of diplomat, educator, whatever kind of word.
Well, you also have to be able to adapt. And in the case here, we were very fortunate in being able to adapt, and now have a location where we're open to the general public, and we have visitors all the time who will come in, and we're always extending the invitation to different school or scouting groups to come down with their advisors or scout leaders and come down and get on the air. You know, we've done things many times at K1USN during the Jamboree on the Air, which takes place in October of each year. So, again, a lot of things have to morph. I guess that's the best way to describe it. But each one of the groups that are on these ships, they're spokesmen for what took place on that ship, but they're also spokesmen for amateur radio.
I think that, I don't know, I mean, how do you go about it? If somebody sees the antenna on your car and they go, what is that? You know, what's your response, Pi? What do you tell them?
Well, I also have that sticker on the back of my car that we were handing out that says, ham radio saves lives. So they usually, if they see the antenna and they've seen the bumper sticker, they at least know that it has something to do with ham radio. So that probably keeps some of the questions from even being asked. They go, oh, that's a ham radio antenna.
Well, you know, I guess, you know, this is really something that we ought to consider. And that is, the league has some excellent little brochures that that talk about ham radio, you know, what it is and all that sort of thing. And I guess we ought to start this right now, you know, right on this here QSO show. We really ought to make an effort as hams to get a handful of those things and just keep them in our vehicles at all times. And that way when somebody looks at the back, like I need to do that today. As soon as we're done with the radio show, I think I'm going to call league headquarters and get a bunch of those to give to my son Matt, because that big antenna, it attracts all kinds of attention.
I bet it does. We have a lot of the ARR literature at our club station. When people come in, we give them that. You know, what's another thing that you could have Matt keep in his car is some of the old magazines. You know, whether it's QST or CQ or you know, magazines like that. When I'm finished reading the magazines, there's a lot of great articles in the magazine. Well, oftentimes I'll leave those magazines at the dentist office. Or at the doctor's office, just leave them there in the waiting room, because they're that way there. I mean, rather than reading the same old you know, a lot of times what's in a doctor's office is pretty boring stuff. And so that's a good way to pass along a little bit of information about the hobby, whether it's a magazine or it's some ARL literature.
That's an excellent idea. I mean, that one will go a long ways. Well, you know, what I was thinking, though, is a lot of our amateur antennas that we have on mobile rigs are you might as well be standing there with a megaphone. I mean, they are a spokesperson for the hobby. And people see, I cannot get over the reaction he gets to this big Tar Heel. I mean,
well, those are pretty impressive.
You know, the people stop and they look and they ask, it just hit me now. I thought, you know, he ought to be able to hand them a little something that kind of explains it, because that there is probably no more of an efficient way of reaching the general public than that, because their curiosity is aroused right on the spot. And once they figure out that this is a form of communication, point to point in its purest sense, I think that there'd be no telling how many guys we could get to ham test online. You know,
that antenna is just a fishing rod. Then
exactly.
It's to draw in new hams.
Yeah, so maybe everybody ought to put one on their car, whether they use it or not, just to be able to.
No, we want them to use it too, though. We want more activity.
Well, to reel in more brethren, get more people to the table, and more folks with a ham license. That would
absolutely.
We're going to take a quick break, and we'll be back with Pi K1RV right after this.
Week after week, you hear us talk about Transworld antennas, and you hear us talk about the TW2010, the 4040, the Backpacker, and all these different antennas. Of course, the TW2010 Adventurer came first. Folks were amazed at its performance. Then they introduced the Backpacker, and now the 4040. Go to eHam and read the reviews on the TW2010. Just go to eHam and read those reviews. Now, you can do that by going to transworldantennas.com. Just go to transworldantennas.com. Transworld Antennas, one word. Go to transworldantennas.com. There's a link on that page that'll take you right straight to the eHam reviews, or you can just go to eHam yourself. And if you're a ham, you know how to get to eHam on the internet. Just Google it, you'll get there. And read the reviews. See what other amateur radio operators are saying about this antenna. Thank you. How many of you would like to operate 80 meters, but you can't because of antenna restrictions? Well, that's over. You can operate 80 meters right now. You can operate from your home, your apartment. You can take it on the road with you. It's the brand new Transworld Antennas 8080. Go to their website and check it out, transworldantennas.com. This is a portable antenna, but it can be a permanent antenna. It's stealth. It's not a low-profile antenna. This thing is a performance-driven piece of engineering. You need to see it. It will be at Dayton, and you need to hear one of these on the air. If you want to operate 80 meters and you can't, I love the 80-meter band. I can't imagine not being able to operate on 80. But nonetheless, if you're in that position, don't stay in that position. Go to the website and check it out, transworldantennas.com. Go up there and take a look at their brand new 8080 and look for it at Dayton. As you're listening to QSO, keep in mind, we would really like to hear from you. We'd like to know where you're listening at. We'd like to know, what are you listening on? How's the signal coming in? Are you listening by means of podcast? Are you downloading from iTunes? What kind of station do you have? How many family members do you have? What do you do for a living? We want to know. We want to know all about who you are. And please write us. Now, what you can do is just go to the website, tedrandall.com. That's TEDRANDALL.com. And there's a tab that says Contact Ted. Jump in there and send us an email and say hello. Plus, it's really important that we hear from you, because it's something that we can show our sponsors. We want to keep QSO on the air, so be sure and write us. Jump on that website, tedrandall.com, and go to Contact Ted and shoot us an email. We'd love to hear from you.
We're back. Our guest is Pi, K1RV. And we've been talking about Museum Ships Weekend this weekend, starting at, 8 o'clock Eastern Time Friday, and going through the entire weekend. The website is www.nj2bb.org. nj2bb.org. I told you we would be giving you that URL, and we'll do it again before the end of the show. Well, you were just talking about a ham radio help group on Yahoo, and you're talking about all the interesting stuff during the breaks. Now, what is
this is a very good group. I've been aware of them for a few years now, and kind of monitor a lot of the activity. And one of the people that there's four or five moderators on there, and one that I've had a lot of contact with. He'd be a good person for you to get in touch with and see if he may. You might be able to get him on the show. But his call is KB9UMT, Uniform Mexico Tango. His name is Don, and it's the Yahoo Ham Radio Help Group. So if you just did a search on Yahoo and put all those words together, Ham Radio Help Group, you'd immediately find that, and you could subscribe to the group and look at some of the traffic that they have on there. But it's a very helpful group, a lot of knowledgeable people that are willing to answer what some of us might consider to be basic questions, but they just figure it's for beginners through to experts in ham radio.
What all have you, I mean, give us just a little bit more detail of the things you've seen on this
site. Well, people will ask a question, you know, I just got my ham license. I don't know anyone locally that I can ask these questions of. What do you recommend as far as a radio? What should I get? They'll compare, you know, they'll say someone has told me about this radio. What do you think about that? What sort of an antenna should I put up? I live in an apartment. What have I? And they'll get a lot of different advice. And, you know, it's usually very good advice. And sometimes if you watch the traffic for a while, you see some of the people that were asking questions 6 months ago now have learned enough that they're actually giving some of the answers to people. So, I mean, it's a great, you can see people learning continually.
That's good. And, you know, there's so many things like this that we don't know about, that we discover as we go along. Of course, the IT or the computer side of things has really opened up some doors that haven't been there available in the past. And it's really streamlined the hobby quite a little bit. I mean, you can really find out a lot of things, you know, online that are related to ham radio. And speaking about online, and talking about shortwave listeners and getting the ham license, one of the things that you are heavily involved with, and that is Ham Test Online. Tell us about this.
Well, Ham Test Online, it's a website that people can they can come on and study for their ham licenses, their technician, general, extra, also the two Canadian licenses, the basic and the advanced. And you know, we've been at this now for about 7 years, and it's fun for us because we just, you know, it's similar to what I see here with some of the people on this that ham radio help group I was talking about, where I see people that come on and they'll say that they have an interest in getting their ham license, and before you know it, they're going like crazy in there, and they're not only getting their technician, but they're going right after that, they're going after their general, and then their extra, and they'll ask me a lot of questions too about, you know, what should I do about this, and then oftentimes I might send them to something like that ham radio help group because it's a useful place for people to learn new things. But Ham Test Online, very simply put, they're courses. They're not. It's not just a thing where you could take a practice exam to. Because for each one of the U.S. exams, there's a certain number of questions in the published question pool, and you know, there's in the technician, there's almost 400 questions in the technician question pool. So if someone were to say that they knew nothing about amateur radio and they wanted to study for their technician license, well, they have 400 questions that are potentially there for them to be asked when they go to sit down and take that 35-question test. So we try to make it as effortless as possible, but make it enjoyable and let and help guide them right along to the point where we say, okay, now we think you're ready to try taking a couple of practice tests, and because you've seen most of the material and you understand it. And then when we see what kind of scores they have there, we say, okay, now put your zip code into this area and find out where the next local test session is for you. And one of the I just had someone here within this past week now. She's I won't disclose her age. I'd say she's a little bit younger than me. But she had no knowledge whatsoever of amateur radio, but she had we had a mutual friend who had told her about us. And within the last 3 months, she went from knowing nothing about amateur radio to just this past week, she passed her extra exam. And she's, I mean, she's just like Emily was at Hamvention that you met. She's her feet still aren't touching on the ground because she passed all three exams.
Let me ask you this question, because there's been a lot of different people talk about different methods of study and all these different things. How much of it today is folks just, I guess I want to say, memorizing the correct answers?
Well, I think there's always going to be that sort of thing. And you know, a lot of people, when they want to study for something, well, we're talking about ham radio here, but studying about anything, the general idea is you have a book that's going to give you an explanation of the things that you need to study and maybe a list of the questions, and you're going to go over it and over it. And if it's something that you're unfamiliar with, you may have to memorize it. So there's still a number of people that do that and that will do that, but we have a little different slant on things that we've developed a software package that will enable us to present the questions to people. But first we present information about the questions and then bring the questions up and start quizzing you on them and then finding how well you do with each one of the questions. And, you know, let's face it, everybody has strong points, things that they would do better in than others. And within a short period of time, we kind of narrow it down and say, well, you know, we're going to make sure that you focus in on this stuff. And before you know it, whether it's memorizing the answers or you've actually learning the material as well as having it burned into your memory bank, and more often than not, I get some of the responses that I get from people when I send study reminders out to people if they don't come back after a week, you know, a week's worth of. Hey, where are you? I send them an email reminder. I say, where are you? I thought you wanted to get your upgrade.
You're skipping class, buddy. You know, get
yeah,
back
well,
to work
and then usually what they'll say is, well, I don't need to study anymore. I just passed the test, and I got 99%, or I got 100%. You know, and so then I go, okay, well, I'll turn off your reminders, or you can turn off your reminders now. But so it really works. Now, whether they're memorizing them, I think. With any type of standardized exam, you must be doing some of that. I mean, obviously, we're working with your memory bank and trying to improve upon it, but we're trying to make it in such a way that some of that is going to stick. Hopefully, a lot of it's going to stick, and you're actually going to understand the stuff.
Well, I think some of the of what happens, too, and the only reason I ask that is I had seen study guides in the past that were just the answers to the questions, and people would say, well, just memorize these, and to me, that's too abstract. In other words, to take an answer to a question and memorize that answer so that it becomes familiar, it's very hard for a lot of folks to accept the fact that I'm memorizing an answer of which I don't even know the question. I don't understand a thing about this, but all I have to do is repeat after me X number of times until that sticks in my brain. And when I go take the test, the correct answer is going to stick out. Boy, that's an abstract way of doing things. I mean,
it is, and it's a pretty time-consuming way too. Now, I like to think that everybody's time is valuable, and I'm constantly watching the website, and I can see who's on studying at any one particular time and how long they've taken to get to a certain stage of, you know, understanding on the various topics. And we encourage people to come on and do a free trial on the website to see, you know, hey, you know, see if this is going to work for you, if this is what you like, and we give them a certain percentage of the questions to work with and see the informational text and see how it interacts with them. Well, some people choose to, you know, for whatever reason, choose to just to stay with a free trial. Well, as I said, it only gives you so much of the informational stuff, and then the people that are staying longer with a free trial, if I look at their study log, I find out, well, they're just basically taking one random exam after another, after another, after another. And I've been watching someone here recently. She has close to 200 hours that she's just been taking random exams. Now, she hasn't upgraded yet, but for 200 hours, I mean, if you think of what the mathematical permutations are on the extra exam, if there's 738 questions, how many times do you have to take a 50-question random test before you've seen them all, let alone understand them?
Yeah, I guess that was always something to me. It seemed like, you know, without some basic understanding, and I mean just, you know, surface level understanding of the question and the answer and what they're talking about, it becomes hard for the brain to justify why I have to store this information.
Right, right. You know,
and that's what I was running into early on when I was much younger. There were companies that had set up schools. Elkins, I think, was one of them. And they gave these crash courses in order to pass the second and first class commercial radio telephone licenses.
Oh, yes, right.
And what amazed me were the people that wound up taking these tests and getting the license that didn't even know what a PL-259 was, you know.
True.
And of course, that was driven back in the days in broadcast radio where the man playing the records on the air was required to take the meter readings, where there used to be engineers. They had done away with most of the full-time engineers for the most part, those guys would walk the towers, take base current readings, take transmitter readings, and other than that, you know, sit in the transmitter shack, occasionally sweep up the stuff off the floor, you know, and repair a few things that are broken, you know. Needless to say, radio stations were in much better technical shape back then than they are today. But because of economics, management decided, well, look, we want the guy that's playing the records to take the meter readings, you know. And they came up with these crash courses to get these guys licensed so they didn't have to have the full-time engineer sitting there, you know.
Right, right.
But what it did is it did create an entire breed of people with first-class licenses that had absolutely no idea which was the plus or minus end of a battery. And and then when I had seen this before, and it seemed to me, Ham Test Online takes you way out of that ballpark and puts you into an area where you can actually learn something. We'll talk about that just in a moment. We'll take a break. We'll be right back with K1RV.
If you already own a TW2010 Adventurer or Backpacker antenna, and you want to use the antenna on 40 meters, you can get the Transworld Adventurer 4040 Array Box in center section only, right now only $139.95. That puts you on 40 meters, and you're dealing with the exact same antenna structure that has made the TW2010 Transworld Adventurer so famous. The black powder coating, the stealth, the way the antenna is able to hide. And in addition to that, it's portable if you want to take it with you. Of course, you can get it with a deluxe travel bag. It's just fantastic. Go to the website and check it out, transworldantennas.com. That's transworldantennas.com. If you can't remember Transworld Antennas, just remember to go to our website at QSO, tedrandall.com, TEDRANDALL.com, and click on the link for Transworld Antennas. Take a look at this brand new Adventurer 4040.
As you're listening to QSO, keep in mind, we would really like to hear from you. We'd like to know where you're listening at. We'd like to know, what are you listening on? How's the signal coming in? Are you listening by means of podcast? Are you downloading from iTunes? What kind of station do you have? How many family members do you have? What do you do for a living? We want to know. We want to know all about who you are. And please write us. Now, what you can do is just go to the website, tedrandall.com. That's TEDRANDALL.com. and there's a tab that says Contact Ted. Jump in there and send us an email and say hello. Plus, it's really important that we hear from you because it's something that we can show our sponsors. We want to keep QSO on the air, so be sure and write us. Jump on that website, tedrandall.com, and go to Contact Ted and shoot us an email. We'd love to hear from you. Our guest, K1RV, and everyone calls him Pi. Right now, of course, he was on the air. We were talking about the museum ships that are going to be on the air this weekend. And we originally started talking about that. And once again, we do want to give you that website again. And that is www.nj2bb.org. That's www.nj2bb.org. And I'm going to have the that website link right on the front page of our QSOradioshow.com page. So if you don't get to write it down, if you're driving along listening somehow, somewhere, and you can't, just go to our website and you'll find it. Now, what I was saying, it seems to me that that Hamtest Online takes you a little bit beyond this. In other words, it takes you a long ways beyond just memorizing the answers. And I think from what I understand, what you're saying, though, is you want to give the folks some basic understanding. Because when you encounter these questions, in order for the brain to access the right answer, I really think you have to have something you can relate to, if that makes sense.
Yeah, that's true. And again, we want to make it something that's, you know, studying is oftentimes a difficult thing for some people, and that's maybe why some people resisted getting into amateur radio many years ago, because they didn't want to have to deal with some, you know, it's a technical hobby. There's no question about it. And I think those of us that have been around for a lot of years like to, you know, we pride ourselves in the fact that we've got some knowledge that that maybe the average citizen doesn't have, because we've done some studying in this area. But a lot of people you know, have a difficulty in studying. So with the software that we've developed, we try to make it as pain-free as possible and enjoyable, but also make it something efficient. And someone had asked us the question when I had to try to come up with some figures when we were at the Dayton Hamvention. They said, well, you know, really, how long does it take if I don't know anything and I want to get my technician, and then if I want to get my general, and if I want to get my extra? And if I had to give a ballpark, if someone were subscribed to the courses and they wanted to get their license and, you know, go at it at a pretty good rate, I would say, if you put in 10 hours studying with us, you could get your technician license. 20 hours for the general, and probably 35 hours or so for the extra. Now, it runs quite a range, though, above and beyond that, and we don't rush anyone. We don't want to rush anyone. Some people, they can't do it fast enough. I mean, they go right at it, and within less than a week, they've got their extra class license. Well, we encourage those people to keep on coming back after they get their license, so that they can, you know, go back and really make sure that there's some of the subjects that we've discussed that you really do have a good knowledge of them. And some other people will take a bit longer because they choose to. But again, if you were to try to do it on a random basis of just randomly going over and over and over the question pool, that would certainly take a lot longer. Just that's my personal experience, just from what I've observed from watching people do it both different ways. So we like the efficiency part.
What about the math? Let's say an individual decides that they're wanting to get a higher grade license, and there is some math involved, and there are some formulas involved, and all that sort of thing. How do you cross that hurdle with Hamtest Online?
Well, let me just say, as far as the math is concerned, the only one of the three licenses that really has any math that would make people kind of cringe, I think, is the extra class license. I mean, you've got some stuff in there that's some pretty abstract concepts for even people that have a basic understanding of algebra. And we're not going to make a mathematician out of anyone. But there have been many times when people have asked questions about, well, you know, how can I really learn to do the algebra? I'll actually send them to some other websites that have some online instructional material regarding the basics of algebra. But if you wanted to get your extra class license and you were just mathematically challenged, and this is coming from someone whose name is 3.14159, you could very easily pass the extra class exam without knowing any of the math. So having said that, the whole thing of studying for that license should be less intimidating for you. It would be wonderful if you understood the math. But realistically, many of the people that have passed their extra class license, they're not mathematicians.
The only thing that I see that could be a real challenge to some folks, and that is because there are people out there who are mathematically challenged. I used to be the code. The code used to, people saw the code as a much bigger mountain than what it really is. And instead of it being something enjoyable to them, they looked at it as a task. I've got to learn this and perform this task, and I think with that in mind, I think that discouraged a lot of folks. I think a lot of folks had a lot of false fear of becoming a radio amateur and passing the test because of that code requirement. On the other hand, since the code requirement has been lifted, we hear across the board from everyone, the people from Vibraplex, people who make code practice CDs and stuff, that they are making more sales and there are more people participating and wanting to learn the code than there was when the code was an actual requirement. And I guess what I'm saying is that, once again, what is the acronym for fear? What is it now? Something false, whatever it is, appearing real or something. I'm sure you know what I'm talking about.
I know what you're saying. I haven't got the exact quote, but I with the people that I have conversation with that are studying for their licenses, oftentimes I have people asking me, they'll say, well, I know that Morse code is no longer a requirement, but can you point me in the right direction? Because I would really like to learn it. And I have definitely seen an increase in desire for people to want to learn the Morse code. So my answer to that question is always to point them to a group that I belong to, I have for a number of years, that's called FISTS, F-I-S-T-S, .org. And that's a subject for another time, but I'd love it if you could, I could put you in touch with the president of FISTS, and she'd be a great interview for you. Her name is Nancy Cott. Whiskey Zulu 8 Charlie, and she'd be a great one to talk all about Morse code and the FISTS group. So maybe we can get you going in that direction, Ted.
That'd be good. I'd love to have them on the air. And there's so many facets of ham radio, especially you've got CW that goes hand in hand with QRP, and there are QRP groups out there. So there's a lot of reasons as to why someone may want to learn the code now or become fascinated with it. But it's not a requirement. So for those that are thinking, well, I'd like to get into ham radio, and that's been something in the past, now you don't have that excuse. The code is no longer a requirement. It is a luxury or an added value, to the hobby that you can participate in along with a lot of other modes. But I brought up the math only because I've heard a lot of folks say, well, you got to memorize all these formulas. But even for the extra class license, if a person feels that they are mathematically challenged and they feel like memorizing formulas and whatnot are a problem, does Ham Test Online? Let me just ask it this way: does it allow you to somewhat get past that? In other words, does it break it down into such a way that you can pass the test without becoming an algebra major?
Absolutely. But as I said, as far as making a mathematician out of someone that doesn't have a real math background, that's a pretty tall order. But one of the things that we do and to try to, you had asked the question about memorization, and I guess it kind of goes hand in hand with this. We, when we present, after we present the informational text regarding the various questions, and then we start asking the questions, well, there's a published question pool that has the questions listed and that gives the answers as A, B, C, D, and, you know, the correct answer to this particular question is C, and then the correct answer to that one is D, et cetera. Well, we don't put any letters in our answers, and we continually rotate the answers. So, you know, if you were studying from a book or a printout of the questions, and you were saying, well, the answer to this question, I don't have a clue, but I know the answer is C, well, we don't give you that as an option. We make so we really want you to learn what the answer is, and we rotate the order of them so the answer one time might appear, the correct answer might be the first one on the list, it might be the third one next time or whatever. So with mathematical questions, we're making sure that you're not just saying, well, I haven't got a clue, but I know that's C. You're going to actually, you're almost forced into learning it because of that.
And I think that's a good thing. You know, it really is, because it also gives a person confidence when they go to take the test. They aren't skittish, or they don't feel like, oh boy, I'm going to fail this for sure. You know, even after all the studies, and I've been in that situation where, especially in school, you sit down to take the test and you know before the pencil hits the paper, you haven't got a prayer, and I'm sure you've been there before as well. Yeah. And, of course, the systematic method of study is the best method of ensuring success on passing any test or getting any kind of certificate, whether it be amateur radio or IT or any sort of license, you know, that you have to, where you have to pass a test and earn a grade in order to be able to get that certificate. And, of course, that systematic method of study and also having someone there kind of overseeing that process. In other words, you know that there's someone there. And there's also somebody you can turn to. You know, you can say, wait a minute, I'm just not getting this. Can you give me a little help here? That's totally invaluable. Let's take a quick break. And then I want to ask you a couple questions about some of the folks that have completed Ham Test Online and got their tickets. And we'll be right back with K1RV right after this. How many of you would like to operate 80 meters, but you can't because of antenna restrictions? Well, that's over. You can operate 80 meters right now. You can operate from your home, your apartment. You can take it on the road with you. It's the brand new Transworld Antennas 8080. Go to their website and check it out. transworldantennas.com. This is a portable antenna, but it can be a permanent antenna. It's stealth. It's not a low-profile antenna. This thing is a performance-driven piece of engineering. You need to see it. It will be at Dayton, and you need to hear one of these on the air. If you want to operate 80 meters and you can't, I love the 80-meter band. I can't imagine not being able to operate on 80. But nonetheless, if you're in that position, don't stay in that position. Go to the website and check it out, transworldantennas.com. Go up there and take a look at their brand new 8080 and look for it at Dayton. K1RV is our guest, and at the break, I keep saying he brings up the most interesting things during the break. He plans on paddling his way through the Museum Ships Weekend.
Boy, that's pretty corny, Ted. You know that?
But you can explain why that is, because now I've got you out. See, now I got you in a corner. You got to talk your way out of it. So.
Yeah, well.
How are you going to paddle your way through the weekend, Pi? Tell us about that.
Well, I mentioned to Ted during the break here that I had, because he was talking about CW, and I had just purchased a new paddle, CW paddle, when I was in at the Dayton Hamvention, and I mentioned a fellow that's from out that way. He's a K8RA, is his call sign, and he's got a great website, K8RA.com, and he's got these super paddles for sending CW. I suppose you could somehow use them to paddle a vessel, but I'll be paddling Morse code is what I'll be doing during the Museum Ships event.
What I wanted to touch on, and that is, tell me a little bit about the customers that have come along and have signed up for Hamtest Online, and give me a little contrast. I mean, what is the highest number of, the highest number of hours you've seen it take to pass a test, and who's been the oldest? I'm not necessarily the name of the oldest person, but what's the oldest age of someone who's actually gone through the course and passed, and the youngest, and some of the little highlights of customers that have come along that you remember?
Well, there's been quite a wide range, and I have a lot of correspondence with them. I'm looking, some people, and when we say the age, a lot of times, we ask people to put in their date of birth. It's just basically something just for comparison's sake. It has, and it's certainly not a requirement, but by doing that, you know, many people like to share that, and we've had a number of people that are less than 10 years old who have studied with us and gotten their technician, their general license, and in a couple of cases, their extras. And on the other end of the spectrum, and I think you met Emily there at Hamvention, and she was she went through and studied with us and got her extra class license, and she's just you couldn't get anyone more enthusiastic than her. We had a woman out on the West Coast. Her name is Louise, and she's now 100. She turned 100 on March 22nd, which was the reason I remember the date is because her birthday and mine are pretty close together, but there's a few years separating us because she just turned 100, and while she was just a kid of 99, she passed her general exam studying with us.
That's amazing.
It is. She's so enthusiastic. She told me a funny story about going down to take the exam because she took her technician with us first and then took a little bit of a break. And then when she came back to study for her general, I could see, you know, she was making good progress. And then I got an email from her, and she said she was so excited. She said she had, I think she had to go to Seattle. It was someplace out there. She had to go for the VE exam. And at her age, she's not driving. So she had to ask a couple of the boys, and she had it in quotations, the boys. And she had told me before that the boys at this senior complex that she lives in were in their mid-80s. So she had a couple of the boys drive her down to the exam session in Seattle, and after that she had to treat them to pizza and beer. And I thought, man, that is so good. And she even sent me a picture of herself with an emergency communications vest on and a walkie-talkie in her hand. So pretty amazing.
That's so cool. That is so cool. See, so there really isn't any boundaries to this.
Oh, well, listen, when people come over to the booth when we were I have a lot of fun at Hamvention because you get to, people will come up and say, gee, thanks for this and thanks for that. Well, sometimes you get people and they'll say, well, you know, I'd like to do this, but man, I'm too old for that. And I just look at them and I say, well, you're not 100, are you? Because if you're anything less than that, there's no excuse.
What do you think, I mean, in watching folks study, what is the longest period of time you've seen someone take? Now, I guess I want to say that'd be an unfair question because some people may take longer because they're just busier, you know, and they don't have the time for the study. Well, somebody that's really, really at it, really studying, what's the longest you've seen, say, for someone to get their general?
Get your general, maybe if you were someone that was seriously studying and you just wanted to, you know, go at it and make, you know, get 100%.
No, wait a minute. What? I'm talking about somebody that's studying that's just extremely dense. And there's a lot of folks
I was trying to say that, but I wanted to say it with a euphemism. I didn't want to.
Okay, all right.
I didn't want to come out and say it like that, but I would say really, realistically, it shouldn't take anyone any more than, say, 35 hours to study for their general using this. Now, that's not saying someone that's just doing practice exams. I'm watching and I see, and if I see someone slip into the thing of practice exams, I'll usually send them an email and I'll say, well, wait a minute, you know, you're not at any stage where you should even be doing that yet. We ordinarily what we'll do is we'll give people a heads up and we'll say, all right, now you can start trying some practice exams, but until then, don't do it, because that just sets things back. You know, it's not giving the chance to see all the material presented as it should.
Well, the reason I ask that is because a lot of folks really underrate themselves, and they think, well, boy, I'm awful dense. This is going to take me forever, you know. And in some cases, you know, maybe they don't have an aptitude for taking tests. And that's another thing, too. I mean, I've seen this, witnessed it myself. You know, there are some very, very intelligent folks that have all kinds of capabilities, and especially in the radio engineering field. I've run into this a number of times. Folks that just really get it, but they can't pass a test. They have just a difficult time. And I was just wondering, how have you observed that? And I would think that Ham Test Online would help those folks get beyond that sort of thing.
Well, it would. I see the log all the time of how many hours people are studying. And oftentimes what they'll do is they'll just stay on there for hundreds of hours, because they've moved into something else that's called our top 10 competitive list, and we keep track of everyone's scores, as you're studying, and you know, naturally you want to get yourself up into the 100th percentile on anything that you're studying for. Well, some people go to the point of just going continually. They'll spend hundreds of hours online, not that they need to pass the test. They may have already passed the test, but they just want to get 100% all the way across the board, so that it's just like in a video game. You know, you like to be on the top 10, have your name up there. Well, people want to have their call signs up there in the top 10, 100% scores all the way across. So some of that, it kind of dilutes me being able to give you an exact figure of how long the longest ones would take.
Well, that's a good educational experience, too, though. I mean, a person, it's just like you said, people play video games to get their names or their initials at the very, very top of the list. And, of course, there's a certain amount of, you know, eye-hand coordination, timing, brain kind of stuff going on that they have to learn and develop a type of skill in order to get there. So I can see where this would have the same sort of effect. In other words, this really does take you beyond memorization. You know, it takes you beyond the hurdles that an individual may have in their head, in terms of, well, I can't pass the math, or goodness, I don't know if I'm going to be able to memorize all these rules and regulations, and you know, all the things that folks contemplate ahead of time thinking they can't do. This really does take you over those rocks and get you right straight to where you want to
well,
be.
Well, I've got a great example here now, because I'm just watching the log running here now on the website.
Mm-hmm.
And let's see if this person has... okay, right here. Here's someone who just subscribed 2 weeks ago, all right? And he started studying. It took him 3 hours and 11 minutes to reach a 100% score on the technician. It took him 5 hours and 47 minutes to reach a 99% score on the general. And after only 3 hours and 26 minutes, he's studying right now. After 3 hours and 26 minutes on the extra class material,
mm-hmm.
he's at 81%. This is a person that's invested, what's this, we're talking about 12 hours, maybe 13 hours worth of time. He's ready to pass his technician general and extra class. Now, there's an extreme. But this person right now, he's probably going to get himself up to, or probably spend a couple more hours here, get a 100% score up on his extra, and then probably try to schedule an exam this weekend.
I want to take a break. Once again, I want to give the museumship website out, which is www.nj2bb.org. And we'll give it out again. But I got a couple more questions for you, Pi, and we'll be back with K1RV right after this. How many of you would like to operate 80 meters, but you can't because of antenna restrictions? Well, that's over.
You can operate 80 meters right now. You can operate from your home, your apartment. You can take it on the road with you. It's the brand new Transworld Antennas 8080. Go to their website and check it out, transworldantennas.com. This is a portable antenna, but it can be a permanent antenna. It's stealth. It's not a low-profile antenna. This thing is a performance-driven piece of engineering. You need to see it. It will be at Dayton, and you need to hear one of these on the air. If you want to operate 80 meters and you can't, I love the 80-meter band. I can't imagine not being able to operate on 80. But nonetheless, if you're in that position, don't stay in that position. Go to the website and check it out, transworldantennas.com. Go up there and take a look at their brand new 8080 and look for it at Dayton. As you're listening to QSO, keep in mind, we would really like to hear from you. We'd like to know where you're listening at. We'd like to know, what are you listening on? How's the signal coming in? Are you listening by means of podcast? Are you downloading from iTunes? What kind of station do you have? How many family members do you have? What do you do for a living? We want to know. We want to know all about who you are. And please write us. Now, what you can do is just go to the website, tedrandall.com. That's TEDRANDALL.com. And there's a tab that says, Contact Ted. Jump in there and send us an email and say hello. Plus, it's really important that we hear from you because it's something that we can show our sponsors. We want to keep QSO on the air, so be sure and write us. Jump on that website, tedrandall.com, and go to Contact Ted and shoot us an email. We'd love to hear from you. K1RV, our guest, and Pi is has joined us to talk about the Museum Ships Weekend. We want to remind you about that coming up this weekend, and that'll start on Friday at about 8 p.m. Eastern. All the frequencies and times, that sort of thing, and all the ships, 78 museum ships, will be on the air this weekend participating in this. And the website is www.nj2bb.org. That's www.nj2bb.org. And we'll give you that URL again, and it'll also be on the website. You know, Pi, I want to ask you some questions here that's kind of unrelated to all of the above. Okay. Tell me a little bit about how you first got interested in amateur radio. What sparked your interest, and what was the path that you went down?
Well, at age 10, 11, somewhere in there, my father got his ham license, and I, at the same time, he got another radio, so I got his older shortwave radio, and I started listening to that back in the late 50s. I started listening to Radio Moscow and BBC and things like that, and I found a few places on the dial where I could hear hams communicating. And so I think I was 13 years old. I was in Boy Scouts, and
what kind of a receiver was it? I'm just curious.
That was a National SW54. Yeah, pretty primitive radio by today's standards. But when I was in the Boy Scouts, we had to learn the Morse code to get one of our, I think it was a second-class badge, and we did it with either lights or flags, and I found out we could use a buzzer. And then, you know, at the same time, my father was doing some Morse code there with the ham radio, and it just seemed like a natural thing. And anything that I could do to avoid schoolwork at the time was something that, you know, myself and a couple of my buddies thought was a cool thing to do. So rather than studying at school, we would spend some of our time studying the old ARL license manual, and got my novice license at age 13, and I've been with it ever since.
You know, let's reminisce here. When you got your novice license, what was the power input requirement? Was it the 75 watts?
That was the 75 watt. You had to be crystal controlled. And back in 1962, if you got a novice license, it was good for only 1 year, and it was not renewable, and you could never get another one. So, the other thing that took place, you could get on the air on CW only, on the high frequency bands, but you also could get on the 2-meter band, and this was a problem because at that time there was a company in Michigan, the Heathkit Radio Company, and one of the things they produced some wonderful stuff, a lot of great kits, and I think all of us that go back in those days had some experience with them. But one of the kits that they had a series of things that had a handle on the top, and they looked like a lunchbox, and they had them for 2 meters and 6 meters and 10 meters. So a lot of the people that got novice licenses, when I did, spent the $45 and bought one of those 2-meter kits and got a crystal for a local frequency, and never and just got on the air and talked on the air on AM back in those days. But then they never pursued anything as far as upgrading their code speed or anything else. And so after a year's time, they were history. They lost interest in amateur radio and just went away. So I was one of the people that enjoyed Morse code back then. So I used to do both and kind of just kept with it and upgraded through the licenses then.
Well, I guess the thing that kept me as a novice on the air and running was collecting QSL cards. You know, and of course, back then, it didn't have to be exotic. It could be a QSL card from a guy across town. It didn't matter, as long as there was just another one to put up on the wall.
I still have some of the ones that used to hang on my wall when I was a kid, and some of those had 3-cent and 4-cent stamps on the back of them.
So you used the Heathkit lunchbox, the tour, I think is what they called it.
Well, no, a lot of the kids that I used to get on the air with a lot of the kids that there was a whole group, some teacher in East Boston had gotten a lot of his students involved, and they had all bought tours. My father, having been involved with the civil defense in town, they used to allocate some civil defense money every year and buy radios and spread them around to the different people that were in civil defense. We had a Cadillac type of radio at the time. It was a Gonset Communicator 4, so that was like a top shelf radio.
Wow. So yeah, I remember that because the tours had the little thumb switch on the front. You
yep.
had to hold it down while you were talking, you know, which is by today's standards, that would make everybody raise their eyebrows and wonder. And I still see some of those around. I saw a couple of them at Dayton floating around.
I did, too. Yeah.
But now, what did you use for, you know, when you first got your novice ticket, what did you use as far as a receiver transmitter? Were you still using the National that your dad had given you, or did you upgrade?
No, that stayed up in my bedroom, but I had an old National. Living in the Boston area, we were near the headquarters of the National Radio Company, and that was a company that made a lot of fine receivers and some transceivers and some of the early sideband transceivers. So we seem to have the ability to buy a lot of them on the secondhand market there. So I had it was a Coast Guard World War II vintage radio, but a pretty selective radio that I used. And I had a transmitter that was built from a kit, which was an ICO, which another company that's no longer with us, but it was a kit company here in the United States.
And that was the transmitter?
That's right.
Okay. It seems like I remember that transmitter. They also sold a separate modulator for it, if you wanted to
use
it.
That's right. I had that, too. I had the ICO. It was an ICO 720, and the modulator was a 730. And I think when you put the modulator on there and you get on AM, you were running all of 35 watts. But it was a pretty good quality signal, and I had a lot of fun with that.
I can recall later down the road, of course, building from kit the ICO 753. Do you remember that radio?
I have a whole story about that that particular radio.
I wanted to put a motor drive on the VFO to keep, you know, it was like the thing had a, it would just go all up and down the dial by
right,
its.
Right.
But go ahead, tell me your story, your 753 story. I'd like to hear that.
It was one of, you know, when that radio, you know exactly how much that radio was worth when that came out. And I had just started working a job after high school, and I was going to college, and I had a little bit of money, and there was someone here in the Boston area who was kind of another legendary character. His name was Herb Gordon. His call was W1IBY, and he had a very distinctive QSL card with a picture of an eyeball and a bumblebee on there. And anyways, he sold a lot of equipment out of his place in Harvard, Massachusetts, so I went with my father one day. We decided to take a ride out there, and I took money out of the bank, and it was $200. When I got the money, to out of the bank. They happened to give me four $50 bills. Well, at age 18 or 19, whatever I was, I had never had a $50 bill before. And when we went out to Herb Gordon's place out in Harvard, I mentioned this to him. He showed us all of his equipment there, and okay, I'm going to buy the Ico 753 kit. And I gave him those four $50 bills, and I still remember it to this day. It was my father and I, and I just made mention of the fact that I had never seen one before, a $50 bill. He reached into his shirt pocket. He had never seen us before, ever. He had a big, thick wad of bills in his pocket. On the outside of it was all $100 bills, which was something I'd never seen. He gave us each $100. He kept on digging into the pile. He took the $100 back, gave us each a $500 bill. These things aren't even, you don't even see these anymore. Further down into the pile, he gave us each a $1,000 bill, and in the very middle, there was a $5,000 bill. So he had $15,000 in 1968 cash in his pocket. That was a lot of money back in those days. Not that it isn't now. But the fact that I had in my hand a $5,000 bill, I've never had one since then. I've never even had anything more than a $100 bill since then. But that was... That all took place because of that that day we decided to ride out and drive out there and buy that Ico 753.
So he was selling the Ico in kit form.
That's correct.
I was trying to remember what those things went for in kit form.
It was, I think it was probably close to $300, and he had bought a whole stock of them, and he had some kind of a special thing going, and it was $200 for the kit.
And did you get the matching power supply and speaker with it?
No.
No.
No, because we built another power supply for that. But, Evan, did you get the matching power supply yourself?
Oh, yeah. I got the matching power supply, and I even got the DC power supply.
Okay, well, so you having had that supply, and I had the homebrew supply, they both thrifted the same, so it was a design flaw in the radio.
Oh, yeah, it definitely was. Matter of fact, there were some modifications or something you could do to it later down the road that I read about, but... And I tried both of those, and it improved it some, but not, you know. But it was still, it was a fun radio because it was very reasonably priced. And, of course, there was the kit factor, which was fun assembling. And, and the fact that you had three bands and a transceiver and at that power level, it was kind of a milestone radio at that time at that price tag, don't you think?
Oh, yeah. And, well, the fact of having the three bands now, that's kind of significant because back in those days, that's when the National Radio Company came out with their three-band radio, the 80, 40, and 20-meter NCX3, and that's because they were at the same stage of the sunspot cycle that we are now, where the 15 and 10-meter bands are pretty barren most of the time because we're down at the sunspot minimum, and it was the same thing when those radios came out.
Yeah, and it was like there was always somebody on the air, and you could always find somebody to talk to with that 753. And as much as I despised its drift, it was manageable though. I mean, I still see those every once in a while. Somebody has one of those things up on eBay, and it kind of surprises me. Some of them in mint condition, you know. And of course, then it was hard to beat. It was really, really difficult to beat the early Heath kits during that era too, where you had the Hot Water 101 and all of those kits that were available at the time. But I'll always remember that Ico 753, and I remember it was a colorful radio too. I think it seemed like the S meter had some red, and there was some blue, light blue paint on the front of it. It had a chrome front, and the little adjustments in the back, which had the Vox and all that on it, were a little blue.
Yeah, well, I was pretty proud of it at the time too. So it was a fun radio, I'll tell you that.
We'll take a break. We'll be back with our last segment here of QSO with K1RV, and we'll be right back after this. Well, that's about it. We don't have any more time, Pi. We've done talked ourselves out of time.
The band is dead, huh?
Yeah. I just want to remind everybody about the Museum Ships Weekend. 78 ships. These are museum ships that are going to be on the air. The website is www.nj2bb.org. And you can go to the QSO website. We'll have a link there for you, and we'll be looking. You may have a chance to work Pi as he is paddling his way through the museum ships
weekend. And the call sign they can look for you under will be?
K1USN, United States Navy.
United States Navy, K1USN. Thank you so much for coming on board and for talking about the museum ships weekend along with Ham Test Online. I've enjoyed this, and I'll have to have you come back soon.
Sure thing, Ted. I've enjoyed it myself. Thank you very much.